Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures and breaks them down into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of both the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today, we're going to continue our discussion about the battle between President Donald Trump's administration and the federal courts. We're going to spotlight the ultra-controversial judicial nomination of Trump loyalist Emil Bovee to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. We're going to talk about what this really means. Judge Gail, let me just take a moment and do two things. One, tell our listeners that there may be some profanity in our broadcast today, not gratuitous, but part of the record. So if profanity offends you, folks, you can tune us off this episode and come back and join us another time. If it doesn't offend you, and again, we're not you use it gratuitously, we'll use it in context, but we wanted to warn you of that ahead of time. Secondly, let's give the public just a little background on Emil Bovee. He is currently the principal associate attorney general and subject to Pam Bondi, but he's the second in command over there at the Department of Justice. He's a longtime Trump attorney. He defended Trump in the Mar-a-Lago confidential documents case. He also defended Trump in the felony case in New York, where Trump was ultimately convicted. This is a man who was a former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. He's now nominated for a seat on the Third District Court of Appeals in Philadelphia. That court is the same one that spawned Justice Samuel Alito on the U.S. Supreme Court. Mr. Bovee has no judicial experience, none, nada, zero. He has no real appellate experience in his practice. His main qualification for this position is that he is the ultimate Trump loyalist. So not only are we looking at Emil Bovee as a potential Court of Appeals judge, but Trump is looking at him for a position on the U.S. Supreme Court. We've talked just briefly in previous episodes about Trump having a falling out with a guy by the name of Leonard Leo, who was one of the heads of the Federalist Society, who vetted judges and justice candidates, nominees for President Trump previously. And Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society brought us justices like Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett. Well, Trump had a falling out with Leonard Leo, and you know, even though you may disagree with the politics of Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, they all had some qualifications going on the bench. Now we might have Bovee going to the top court in the United States, the U.S. Supreme Court. He's at the top of Trump's list because Trump is not going to the Federalist Society anymore. He's picking his own nominees. All right, that's background. Judge,
is any part of that unsettling to you? I was listening,
it's
and
all
I'm
unsettling
just
to me. My stomach's roiling already. All of it is, and especially, you know, I was thinking about this last night, actually, and I was thinking, okay, what move could Trump make to put Bovee on the Supreme Court? Well, could he convince Clarence Thomas to retire. Well, that's possible, but that wouldn't give him an extra vote. Can he pressure one of the three liberal justices to leave? Well, that's not likely, although there's some health concerns in that group, reportedly.
But they also have a pretty much a supermajority, meaning conservatives pretty much already have a supermajority on the Supreme Court.
But my nightmare, you ask if I was unsettled? Okay. My nightmare is that Chief Justice Roberts says, I'm done. I'm out of here. I've done my bit. I've already been labeled the worst Chief Justice of all time. I'm done. And Beauvais would be nominated as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. That's my unsettling concern. That was my nightmare right before I tried to go to sleep last night.
I cannot imagine that you slept well.
I did not. Hence, I spilled a whole cup of coffee this morning. It's not been a good day.
You woke up shaking.
Yeah, you got it.
Thinking about your last thoughts before you lay down last night.
I think to put all this in context, though, we ought to give some background about the nomination process of federal judges and how all that takes place and what that means. So I'm going to let you do that.
And why it matters, right?
And why it matters. That's right.
When we talk about federal judges versus state and local judges, I think it's so important to make sure that we're making these distinctions for our listeners, because one of the prevailing qualities that federal judges are comforted with that other judges in many jurisdictions are not is the fact that they go through, and if they are successful through an appointment process, it is for what's called a lifetime, meaning there are no political campaigns, there are no fundraising, there's no renomination or reappointment process. There's no retention process, meaning after a while you're evaluated and it's determined whether or not you should remain in that seat. You can remain a federal judge for the balance of your career, however long you want that to be.
Pending
good behavior, meaning your removal, you can be impeached and you can be removed based on bad behavior.
But you got to be indicted and convicted.
It's a really high bar. Let's just put it that way.
That's not going to happen.
It's not as easy as mixing up a pitcher of Kool-Aid.
No.
It's a pretty high bar to do that. And also for federal judges, again, you can move from active status to what's called senior status, which means as you become.
You stay around till you die.
You really can. You can literally die in your chambers if you want to. Whereas there are other states who literally require that you leave, like pack your bags and get out at a certain point, which is often marked by a certain number of birthdays. So understand that this is a unique process, largely for federal judges. That's why it's called federal appointment. And the reason is because there is a nomination that is made usually by the executive branch and is
by the president.
But yes. And that nomination also is supported by what's called the home state senators. So usually the home state senators will support or decline to support the nomination. But if it is supported, that is when the process of the appointment begins. It starts with a background check. So if anyone is ever interested in becoming a federal judge, just know that everything you have ever done, even when you took an extra snack in your lunch during kindergarten, they're going to find all of this out. Okay. So this background check goes way back deep into your background, because it's really thoughtful, because the idea is that with a lifetime appointment, what you want are to appoint individuals who are, you know, not known for unscrupulous behavior, who have reputations that are beyond reproach, who are not perhaps subject and potentially subject to being bribed or influenced. Judicial independence is really, or at least was, really kind of the hallmark of the judiciary. So ensuring
people who don't have drug or alcohol addictions that are known.
Prior arrests or prior indictments or, you know, anything, you know, even, you know, the smallest things that have nothing to do with criminal behavior, but things that could, you know, cause or bring embarrassment to the president or, you know, or to others, which that is a pretty relative phrase these days. Okay. Can we just pause and talk about what it means to bring embarrassment? Because I think the current administration is just kind of
beyond embarrassed.
They can't be embarrassed. They're just like, there's no such thing as embarrassment. And so that is a non-issue. I think there's more of a concern within this administration about how those judges will rule and whether or not their rulings will be consistent with the perhaps policy and maybe even political leanings of the administration, as opposed to kind of that what we've known and celebrated as an independent judiciary. At least that's how it appears. I think there's a certain amount of focus that this administration places on the idea that when you read a judge's name, soon thereafter, you read about who appointed them and why
Biden
they were there.
Biden appointee, Obama appointee, Reagan appointee,
exactly.
Trump appointee.
Exactly. And this we had not seen before. I mean, if you think back, you know, 5, 7, 10 years, or I will say the pre-Trump era, whenever, you know, everything that predated that, you rarely ever saw the name of a judge, and then almost immediately following, when you were reading an article, almost immediately following the name of the appointing president. That just, it didn't
if
matter.
If it was mentioned at all, it was way down in the story.
Correct. You almost know, to the point where you'd be hard pressed to connect the two. You were like, wait, why did they even bother mentioning that? Now, it is almost impossible to read something, especially when you're talking about federal judges, like Mr. Beauvais is currently nominated for a federal appellate seat. It's almost impossible to read something and not instantly know what administration and what president nominated them. To me, it's kind of offensive, but to some, they actually celebrate it because they want to ensure that the rulings of the court are consistent with the, you know, political leanings of their appointer. And I think that there should be clear disconnect between the two.
Let me jump in here, and I want you to continue, please. But let me jump in here, and just for our listeners' sake, contrast this to the states, is that federal judges are appointed, and as Judge Gale indicated, they're appointed for life. In well over half of the states in the United States, judges are elected. Mm-hmm. In some form. Some are elected straight out in competitive elections, candidate against candidate. Some are appointed by some process, either through the governor or through a commission, and then stand for re-election.
Or retention,
Or retention. Mm-hmm. States, the idea is that judges should be reflective of the constituency that they represent, and that constituency appoints them to the bench through the voting process. That is totally alien to the federal system. The federal system says, okay, by contrast, we're going to say that judicial independence is so important that we're going to have a person appointed, but appointed for life. So they won't have to worry about re-election. They're not, you know, licking their finger and putting it up in the wind, see which way the wind blows. Technically, it's supposed to be an appointment for a lifetime position without politics.
I think it's also designed to kind of remove the influence of politics. I think that perhaps the original intent.
I wanted to make that contrast because it's so different in the federal system.
You're right. But here's what I'll also note for the benefit of our listeners is that there are actually some states that follow a federal type of system.
True.
When selecting their state judges. We tend to see more of this in the New England states. So states like Maine, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Delaware, New Hampshire, et cetera, those states tend to follow a practice where many of their judges are also appointed for life. Now, a lifetime appointment does not mean that you cannot matriculate to another bench. So for example, if you are a trial court judge and you desire to become an appellate judge, merely because you have been appointed, even in the federal system, because you've been appointed to a trial seat, doesn't mean that you cannot then be considered or promoted, if you will, to a higher seat. For example, take Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, who was, prior to becoming a United States Supreme Court justice, was an appellate judge in the District of Columbia. And so,
where a lot of Supreme Court justices have come from.
Precisely, which is, I think, goes to your point with regard to Mr. Beauvais not having had any prior judicial experience. We see that a lot, especially in jurisdictions where judges are elected. Right. Because if you are elected and you are running on your credentials, what we have done is we've now placed essentially the power to hire and fire judges into the hands of the citizenry. Because remember, for every time there's an election cycle, it's almost like re-interviewing for your job. You go back to the electorate and you ask them if they'll hire you again, if they'll let you keep your job.
Let me add just one humorous note. When I was elected judge, I was very young. I was 31 years old. I was the youngest elected judge in Ohio at the time.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
But I wonder why you grade early.
That's true. But so the first judicial conference I went to, this older judge who I had a great deal of respect for and I had tried cases in front of as an attorney came up to me and said, "Welcome, son, to a terminal position."
Uh-oh.
And I said, "What do you mean a terminal position?" He said, "Son, if you do your job correctly, you're going to piss off more than 50% of the electorate at some point, and you will leave your position. They will vote you out. So I always view this as a terminal position. So welcome to that terminal position."
That's one way of looking at it.
Yeah.
And in many instances, it's not the electorate that you piss off. Sometimes it's, the politics of the environment.
Right.
And that's enough to make you just say, you know what?
I'm done.
I'm done. I've had enough. So that the listeners understand, there are a couple different paths to the bench. In some jurisdictions, the electorate doesn't choose, and you're right, you can have a governing body that decides who the judges are. And that can be everything from a county commission to a governor to
commission of attorneys and
yes,
politicians and
precisely,
all kinds of different machinations of that.
In fact, I think you and I are familiar with, in Ohio, there's this animal called a mayor's court. And,
right,
it's really interesting because it's literally a court. The judges for the mayor's courts are appointed by the mayors, and they are not judges in the
some are not attorneys.
And some of them are not even attorneys, but they are lay judges, if you will, in these mayor's courts. And it's funny that you mention that, because there are other states throughout the country whose judges, who actually sit and they hear and they decide on the same levels and seriousness of cases who are also lay individuals. So in some jurisdictions, in some states, you can be a judge without having had formal legal training, without having ever attended law school, without ever having taken a bar exam or being a licensed attorney and never having practiced. And so I suppose by comparison, Mr. Beauvais having the credentials that he does have, if you compare that to maybe some other judges in some other jurisdictions, he's perhaps met the standard and exceeded it. But I go back to your point of this being a federal judgeship and a federal system where the stakes are considerably higher, because also remember at the federal level, the effect or the impact on large swaths of the country is far greater than what would happen at a state level or a local level. And so that's why this is so important. What's more is, and to your point, Judge Tom, is the fact that Mr. Beauvais is not being considered for a trial court seat. He is being considered for an appellate seat, which means, in my view, they're still kind of, even though he was a prosecutor and he's had experience as a litigator, I think that, and I think both of us will agree, having been prosecutor and defense, you being a, having been a defense attorney, that the view from the room as a jurist is different from that as a litigator. And that there, and I'm not suggesting that every judge should start off or be required to start off as a trial court judge, but what I am saying is that there is great value in having had the experience as a trial court judge, but also in addition to that, as a trial court judge, also or having had experience in an appellate courtroom setting. There are many judges, appellate judges statewide and elsewhere, who are sitting on the bench and they've never even been in an appellate court. So they don't know the operations of or even the mechanics of an appellate argument and what it is that you're seeking to achieve when you go before an appellate bench. And ascending to that bench, I think, requires having had some exposure, or should require having had some exposure to it. And I don't know that Mr. Beauvais brings that.
Okay, let me jump in here, because in states, you know, there's no requirement of this, but normally you start off your judicial career as a trial judge at various levels of courts around the country. Then you try to up your game to the intermediate level appellate court, district court or circuit court of appeals, and then maybe up to a state Supreme Court. But it's almost a stair step. It's not written anywhere, but that's in practice the way it works. Mm-hmm. In the federal system, though, you can jump over that. And you may have had experience at the district trial court level, either as a judge or a litigator. But when you get to that appellate level, that's a whole different ballgame. Mm-hmm. And in Beauvais' case, yeah, he had checkered experience as a trial lawyer. but then now he's being put on or nominated to be put on a major appellate court, and he hasn't even done appellate work as an attorney. So
yeah, that's what. Yeah, I think that's what emphasize your concerning. Point. Yes, yeah. is not having had the experience or the exposure to the very bench that you're seeking to ascend to is pretty hard. And I think, and I'll say as an aside, I also think this is where there is great value in leaning into and relying upon recommendations from nonpartisan organizations like the American Bar Association.
Right. As to whether somebody is qualified or, you know, they don't say this is the person we want, but it's been historic that they've said this person's qualified or this person's not qualified.
Or that this person is highly qualified. And exactly. That vetting, that independent vetting, can really also take the mystery out of the process for a lot of people who sit by or sit on the sidelines without truly understanding this. And then you still have people who say, well, why should I care? This is a federal appeals court. It doesn't affect me. If I get a traffic ticket, I'm never going to end up there. And it's entirely possible that yes, you could get a traffic ticket and you could never end up there. It's equally possible that there could be some very, very nuanced, series of experiences that does land you in a federal court and therefore in front of a federal appellate court. And these things matter because, again, federal judges have broad authority to affect and impact the lives of Americans across the nation. And so we should all be looking at these nominations with kind of eagle eyes and wondering, okay, what does this judge stand for? Or what is it that we could or should expect by way of rulings? And even though judges are ethically forbidden from making pronouncements about what they will do in specific cases or how they will rule in specific instances, there's a lot about their background and, as to your point, Judge Tom, their experience or lack thereof, and right, their appreciation for the rule of law, their respect for the court and judicial system. Because remember, like I said, they'll comb through your background and they'll find out if you've ever been disciplined or if you have shown, disregard or disrespect. You can best believe that all of these things are going to come to light, and anything that would make you an insufficient candidate will certainly be raised for further inspection and certainly almost interrogation during the nomination process, which I think has become one of the calling cards of this experience for Mr. Beauvais, is his prior history, not just as the president's attorney in the New York case or
right,
in the Mar-a-Lago case, but his prior history yeah, as a managing litigator at DOJ, but also his recent history professionally and his current role at DOJ, given, and how we've mentioned this in prior podcasts, given the push and pull right, and what is clearly a fever pitch level of static between the court and the Department of Justice and what's been done to kind of erode that trust.
You're on a roll here. Let me interrupt. You're on a roll.
Hop on okay, in here.
Take a breath. I need to jump in here. Take a breath. Normally, and one of the differences that we've seen evolve over probably the last, certainly since 2016, but even before that, probably, the courts of appeal positions, especially federal appellate positions on circuit courts around the country, have always given the aura of being scholarly positions, where you parse the law, you look at the law and the facts and the Constitution, and you come out with what you believe as a trio of judges or whatever is the proper decision based on your scholarly analysis. Recent appointments, and especially this appointment, has absolutely nothing to do with scholarly excellence. This is a pure political appointment, and that's a huge difference. And you ask if I'm unsettled? Yes. Making pure political appointments to something as important as a federal appellate position drives me crazy.
And I think what we've learned, or at least what we've come to expect, is exactly what you are most concerned about, which is we have come to expect a bench of judges that are truly tethered and have a deep and abiding both love, respect, and appreciation, or not both, but all of love, respect, and appreciation for the rule of law. And that there is, right, notwithstanding whomever appoints them, that for them, there is no daylight between those characteristics. And what we see when we, again, and if these are not purely political appointments, then that's fine. Please, you know, please force us to believe otherwise, because it at least doesn't appear to be anything short of that. And if that is the status of things, if that's now the only requirement, is that, and I think, you know, in part, we may have seen some of this in the first Trump administration. And I say that because I go back to, I believe it was Judge Kaczmarek, who's in Texas, and he's in the one district in Texas. And what is unfortunate about that by comparison to this nomination is what we had seen for a period of time is we'd seen forum shopping. And so Judge Kaczmarek's opinions were, and his certainly his leanings were on full display. And because of that, you had individuals who were filing where instances had taken place in other states and other jurisdictions, but they would purposely file
in Texas,
so that the case could land on Judge Kaczmarek's docket, and understanding and knowing that he was likely to rule a certain way. I'll tell you, the Mifepristone case was, you know, one of the examples of this form of this type of forum shopping, meaning when it came to whether or not, you know, the FDA was now going to be, you know, no longer approved to administer the Mifepristone, that case was actually filed in Texas, unfortunately. And not because there was any connectivity to Texas, it was just because there was this clear understanding that this judge will rule this way on this particular issue. So let's make sure we get it in front of this particular judge, right, so that we can score the big win. And the result was that even the federal bench had to come together and set new rules for how cases would now be assigned in those instances, because yes, in where Judge Kaczmarek is, there's no one else. It's not like there's a pool of other judges to pick from. It's not even like there's another federal court that is, you know, immediately nearby. So the rules actually had to be changed to prevent this pervasive behavior from happening. And it's really hard to look at that and to not believe that the original intent of appointing someone of this nature, and I'm not saying this because I don't know Judge Kaczmarek personally. All I know is, just like every other judge, from is that he speaks one way through his, right, orders. And right, so if you look and you read the orders and you read the sequence of events, you can only come away with this one understanding. And it is really hard to swallow the idea that the nomination and the ultimate appointment and placement of Judge Kaczmarek was not purposely done for the point of achieving the goal of, you know, successful forum shopping. We can take our cases to this court and get this outcome because we know that more often than not, this is how it's going to shake out. Well, that's exactly what's happened. And to your point regarding the appellate side of it, it now, given again the history of what's happened and what we've seen happen, and given the connectivity of Mr. Bove to the not the current administration, but also in his previous dealings as a personal attorney to the current president, it does become very difficult to disbelieve the idea that this is not purely political, or that even if there are other elements that could substantiate a nomination of Mr. Bove, the prevailing factor is the connectivity that he personally has to the administration, and not his work ethic in the past, not his proclivity for, you know, academic scholarship, or his, you know, his writings and publications, none of those things, because none of that is evidence here. All that is evident is exactly what you said, which is the fact that he has kind of this pre-existing relationship with this administration, which at least appears that this nomination is a reward for that kind of loyalty or that type of connectivity or relationship, which is an offense to the rule of law and certainly to an independent judiciary. And I don't know, and I'll ask you to chime in here. I don't know how successful his nomination will be, except that, you know, it appears that, you know, whatever the desires of the administration is, they somehow managed to manifest. But given the concerns and the deep concerns that have been raised, I am not certain how successful this nomination will be, especially in light of what has at least been reported so far as a lot of the nose thumbing, or maybe I should say the middle finger sticking to the judiciary that he seeks to join.
Well, let's just look at Mr. Bove before we reach the conclusion of what's going to happen with his nomination, and we'll build up to the biggie. But, you know, just some things that I think are important for people to know. The Alliance for Justice put together a fact sheet on Mr. Bove. And one of the things that they mentioned was that he launched an investigation as Associate Deputy Attorney General into Special Counsel Jack Smith and his team, accusing those who investigated the Capitol insurrectionists of using improper investigative techniques and unethical prosecutions. On January 31st of this year, Bove sent a memo to the acting FBI director instructing them to effectuate the termination of FBI employees involved in investigating and prosecuting January 6th insurrectionists. That's two things, just two things.
And I think that there's, I mean, I know that there are still those on, you know, one side or the other of this argument, but there, I think that there are enough Americans that, you know, for those of us who, you know, have been through enough, we've seen enough, that our lying eyes were not deceiving us on January 6th, right? So people saw what they saw, right, and they understood what they were looking at. And it was, there was plenty of shock and horror. And it certainly, to me, kind of now begs the question of, you know, after having seen what we saw and everything that took place, I often wonder, like, does this really rise, following through on this and investigating this and ensuring that something like this never happens again, are we going to suggest that this is the heel that prosecutors were dying on? Like, they don't always get to pick their cases, right? They right. are assigned something, they do it, right. they follow through. They don't right. get to decide, hey, you know what, this might come back to bite me in the hind parts politically, right. so I'm not going to take this case. They do that, and they do it without ever believing, for 3 seconds, that this is going to be the thing that results in their termination. That's just shocking to me.
Well, he goes on with his list of most popular hits. Mr. Bove also was the lead person instrumental in getting the feds to drop all of the criminal charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams.
Now, that smells like a New York sewer to me. And I will tell you, that was just really, really shocking to me.
Well, it's evidence stinks. That political aspect of everything.
It absolutely stinks. And that in and of itself. Now, here's the thing. So, and again, these are federal cases. And I think we've said to our audience before, listen, we all know when the feds come knocking, it's never good news. And as to Mayor Adams, when Mayor Adams was indicted, now, mind you, we're not talking about Mayor Adams merely being, you know, investigated or Mayor Adams just questioned, or
he was on the train to trial.
There was an actual document that said United States versus Eric Adams. And there were charges that were associated with this, which, and I think we discussed this before, by the time the feds are indicting an individual, they have expended a considerable amount of resources, because the goal should be to indict with an eye toward beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the highest standard of proof that our justice system recognizes. We're not talking about probable cause, which is the lowest. They're indicting knowing that they have put together a fairly substantial case that is winnable at trial. Now, it doesn't mean that because they're the feds that they're completely invincible and they can never lose and, you know, nothing ever happens to them. Listen, if nothing else, we know from, you know, the recent case with Sean Combs that the federal government can lose and they can lose substantial charges. But here's what we also know is that that same level of investigative resources that goes into every other federal case clearly and most assuredly went into indicting Mayor Adams. So it wasn't, in my belief, it's not that there's any suggestion that those indictments lacked the evidence to support what could have been in high likelihood, what could have been a conviction. What stinks to me is kind of the knee-jerk reaction of dismissing the indictment. I think even the judge in that matter said, you know what, this doesn't smell good. Because if you'll recall, Judge Tom, the original idea was to dismiss it without prejudice, which means right. It would have been left hanging over Mayor Adams' head. One would assume to force compliance with whatever the quid pro quo is or whatever the agreement is. And I think you gave this analogy before. It's like placing the file on a desk in a room, and to dismiss it without prejudice. Without prejudice means that you are able to walk out of that room and you can take the keys with you and you can lock the door. And there may or may not be an intent to come back to it, but you can always unlock that door and go back to it and pick that file up and start again. If you dismiss with prejudice, then that means you've put that file on the desk in that room and you have welded the door shut and there is no returning to it whatsoever. And I think the judge in that Eric Adams case told the government that the judge will not permit a mere dismissal without prejudice, because it really does reek of that quid pro quo of, hey, we're going to go back and we're going to bring this case back if you don't do exactly what we've agreed to or what we said, versus if you legitimately have no case and you really use taxpayer dollars and you've used all these resources to bring this indictment, and now you're suggesting, you know what, we didn't really mean it because we don't really have what we need to prosecute this case, then you will dismiss it with prejudice and you will let Mayor Adams off the hook completely, which is ultimately what had to happen.
Moving on from Mayor Adams, which I agree with what you've said 100%.
And that's where the New York sewer part comes in.
Let's hit some high points on other aspects of Mr. Beauvais. Let's look at civil rights, racial justice, that kind of thing. He has advocated for policies that encourages racial profiling, particularly of Black and Brown communities, purposely fostering fear and suspicion around citizenship status. And rights of entire groups of people. He launched an investigation of the Department of Justice people and the FBI people who were involved in getting the search warrant on Mar-a-Lago. He called it the unprecedented raid on the president's home. You know, so he is investigating those people for retribution. You know, one of his first acts relating to the environment was on targeting and firing all federal contractors and eliminating funding for environmental justice programs and policies. You know, so this is a guy who's using the Justice Department as a political weapon, and we think he's not going to do that as a judge. One last thing before I shut up here. Mm-hmm. One last thing is on judicial temperament. You know, judicial temperament is, for our listeners, is a big deal. You know, you can't be a raving maniac on the bench. You can't have high highs and low lows. The ideal judge is one that is steady as you go.
And pinches his thigh instead of laughing out loud.
That's right. Pinches my thigh instead. I still have scars. Pinching my thigh instead of laughing out loud. Judicial temperament. Well, while Beauvais was a federal prosecutor in Manhattan in the U.S. Attorney's Office, that office conducted an internal inquiry into his leadership of terrorism and international narcotics unit, saying that his style was abusive, his management style was abusive, and that he would have fits of temper.
Is that the same as fits of rage?
I think something like that. The investigation led to recommendations that he be demoted from his position. He was also subject of a letter that was brought up in the Senate hearings, a letter to his office leadership by a group of both defense attorneys and colleague prosecutors who had worked with him, saying he had used questionable tactics while litigating cases.
Wow.
You know, so your ethics on the line here, your temperament on the line here, those do not bode well for someone who's going to sit in judgment.
And not to mention your reputation, right? So you have ethics, you have temperament, and the accounts of these experiences are reputational. So that's, and again, what it sounded like I was going to say earlier when you were outlining some of the allegations and just some of the actions that he's taken in his current position, unfortunately, it strikes me as someone who should not be vested with so much power and authority. And not because it's not important and necessary to have power and authority in those positions, but it is, at least seems clear that it matters as much, if not more, who you vest with the authority than the authority itself, because it determines how it will be used. And right. He, at least from this catalog of experiences, has apparently demonstrated a clear willingness to abuse the power and to not respect it and use it in a manner that also respects the rule of law and his role, no matter the role he's holding. I mean, I think that's one of the things that you and I have talked about quite a bit in our experiences as judges, understanding that when you put the robe on and you ascend the bench, you are automatically vested with a considerable amount of power and authority. But merely having it does not mean you use it in every instance. It does not suggest that you just completely detach yourself.
Sometimes you restrain.
And many times you do, right? Yeah. I mean, how many times have you, and I know that I've had it, how many times have you been frustrated with someone? And, you know, the thought of holding them in contempt certainly crosses your mind. And instead, you have to decide exactly how you will approach the situation and whether or not that inclination to either hold them in contempt or to put them in a holding cell or to impose the most severe fine or penalty or whatever that is, you have to think about what the effect of that is going to be.
You take a breath and you count. And yep. you say, I'm not going to do this knee jerk because Absolutely. If I do, it's not going to bode well for the impression that people have on the justice system and the courts.
Exactly. And it's not going to achieve the end goal that you also want to see in that particular case.
That's right.
If you want changed behavior, if you want someone to be, you know, remorseful, if you want to make this right for the victim, then it is incumbent upon you as a jurist to demonstrate that high level of emotional intelligence and temperament that is necessary in every kind of case, not right. just right. one or two, but all of them.
Right. Hey, we've got about 8 minutes left, and we've got to get to the big one. The big one is his view of following federal court orders. The whistleblower that has provided Congress with documentation that Emile Beauvais basically told Department of Justice people that they should consider saying fuck you to judges and federal courts who enjoin deportations.
And I'll tell you, it wasn't even basically. There were text messages that were released. And the text messages says to tell the court, fuck you.
And not only text messages, but colleagues going back and forth in real time of him using those words. Now, you've got a nominee for an appellate court decision who is saying, fuck you to federal judges and following federal court orders. Mm-hmm. How can it get much worse?
I mean, and it's the documents speak for themselves. And that's what we call res ipsa loquitur. The thing speaks for
itself. Oh, there you go with that Latin again. Damn.
It speaks
res
for
itself. Res ipsa loquitur.
That's what it is. Res ipsa loquitur. The thing speaks for itself. And I think what's important to understand is, you know, there may be possibly some argument and wiggle room here were this not a nomination for a federal judicial seat. It actually just is quite hypocritical and comedic to me that there would be the consideration of someone for a federal judicial seat whose sentiment toward the court is as has been described.
We're not going to follow your orders. We don't care what you say.
Here's a middle finger. Sit and spin, judges. We have no intent on following your court order. And again, that is from someone who now seeks to join the ranks of those who will no doubt, were he appointed, he will issue court orders. Court orders that he fully would And should, rightfully should, expect will be followed, will be honored.
But not only by litigants, but by lower courts.
Yes, yes. And so the amazing hypocrisy of this is, oh my gosh, we have a nominee that actually carries this type of animus toward the very space he seeks to occupy. That's amazing to me, because if you'll recall, I think it was during the Biden administration, by contrast, I forget the judge's name who was set for nomination. And I want to say it was Senator Marsha Blackburn. It might have been someone else who pulled in. And because the nominee was a black male, or in part because, I don't know if it was exclusively because, but in part, he was a black male, she pulled his rap sheet, or what she called his rap sheet, his record of arrests and prosecutions. That's what RAP stands for, record of arrests and prosecution. And he had none. At most, they were minor infractions from when he was considerably younger. But the suggestion was that the nominee was not an upstanding member of the bar, that he had was, you know, he flouted the rules, that he was, you know, someone who did not abide by rules. So why should he be rewarded with a judicial seat? And if somebody's record of traffic arrests or, you know, minor involvements with law enforcement could possibly be held against them in a nomination hearing, I am struggling to understand why something like this with regard to Mr. Beauvais, who, by the way, I've only started calling him Beauvais during this podcast because I thought his surname was Bove, but I am apparently wrong.
Well, it's been pronounced two ways, Bovey and Beauvais. So either one of those are correct, but Bove, no.
Bove is not it. So it's definitely not Emil Bove. We know that. It's neither Bovey or Beauvais, but in either instance, my pronunciation was incorrect. But I guess my point here is that, you know, there was a time when something like this, even a suggestion of something like this, would not have even permitted someone to make it to a full hearing.
Oh, no. They would have been withdrawn. They would have been forced to withdraw their nomination before a hearing. But this whistleblower came out with all of these, the whistleblower, former Department of Justice prosecutor who was fired for telling the truth to the court, by the way. Mm-hmm. You know, he brought all of this, and it was interesting, the typical dodge of somebody who's being confirmed and going through the Senate confirmation process. Senator Adam Schiff, Democrat from California, mm-hmm. you know, said, you know, you were accused of basically saying fuck you to the courts and advising your staff to follow that policy. Do you recall doing that? Or did you do that? And Beauvais' response was, I don't recall. I don't think I did that, but I don't recall. You know, the I don't recall dodge just gives me a pain in the posterior.
Well, you know? Again, it's that is kind of the standby, right? Is the
it's the go-to. I don't recall.
Which should probably give them cause for pause when it comes to, you know, appointing somebody to such a high court who struggles with memory lapses so early in their career. So
on something so profound.
Profound. You're like, well, wait a minute. I don't know if he's fit to serve because he can't remember that well. So that might go to the issue of fitness as much as it does truthfulness, candor, or respect and temperament. It might be, you know, I don't know. You don't.
Well, he's being, now that the whistleblowers given all this information out, now he's being accused of possibly perjuring himself before the Senate committee. And right now that's just sitting there. Nobody's taking much action about it, but things will, I think, heat up pretty quickly. Just real quickly, the background of this FU to the courts is this case where, remember, the planes were headed to El Salvador with a bunch of people that had been picked up and not given any due process rights.
Yes, and Judge Bosberg, I believe.
Judge Bosberg ordered that the planes be returned, and Beauvais was the guy who orchestrated the sandbagging of that to the court, and perhaps even the lying of that, certainly disinformation given to the court. And Bosberg ultimately set a hearing for contempt that's been put on hold by higher courts. But Beauvais was the guy instrumental in basically sending the people to El Salvador and saying, fuck you to the court. That's the guy.
And this is the guy who wants to join the very court that which he has very little respect for.
Do you feel better? I'm still unsettled. I'm in fact more worked up now than when we started.
But. Oh, goodness. Well, again, I think your feelings of being unsettled are well placed. And because I think we have such an enduring commitment to the rule of law. And so when we see it, you know, offended in such a way that, and, you know, you feel like, my goodness, how dare you even desire to be a jurist when this is how you treat the court, when you don't have the power to issue orders. My goodness, what happens when we vest you with more power? That you've already shown us what you do with the amount of power you've been given. It becomes a bit scary. If past behavior is a predictor of future behavior, it becomes really scary to think about what happens when we vest you with more.
Well, the Washington Monthly, let me end with this quote. The Washington Monthly on July 14th came out with a story on the whistleblower. But I want to read this one quick paragraph. It says, Emile Beauvais, make no mistake about it, is on a fast track to the Supreme Court. He is loyal to a fault, but to him, justice is a game and a political weapon. The country deserves another Brandeis, but Trump is giving them another Roy Cohn. Is that perfect or what?
Wow. Wow. It's poetic.
But it's perfect. Mm-hmm. Hey, Judge, mm-hmm. we got to wrap it up. How do people find us if they want to hear more of our deliberations
here? Right, and our banter here. But we are grateful to our listeners, and we invite you to check out Next Witness, Please, any and everywhere you find your favorite podcast. We'd like to give a special shout out and thanks to our primary host, NPR, National Public Radio, for providing us the opportunity to give you what we think is such important information. But if you get your podcasts from other spaces and other places, we invite you to check us out on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or as I said, anywhere else you find your favorite podcasts. We believe that you don't trust what you don't understand. And so our hope is that with these episodes, you have increased your understanding and that we have improved your trust.
And if you have any questions or comments about our podcast, you can always email them to me directly. That's at hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, @ohio.edu. Also, if you have topics for us you'd like to hear us talk about in the future, shoot those to us and do that by email as well. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media, part of Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer, and let me just give a shout out to Colin. I mention him every single time. However, you don't understand, folks out there, all that he does. Judge Gale's in Cleveland area. I'm in Massachusetts. Colin is at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. When we have guests, sometimes they're from Maryland or D.C., Colin pulls all of this together and makes us sound good. So a big shout out to Colin. He's part of our team as a co-producer, but he's also an excellent audio engineer, and we thank him for all the work that he does for us.
I echo that sentiment, Colin. You are amazing, and thank you for all of your masterful work.
Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.